Today we're going to be getting into Daniel chapter 7. One of the things that we'll see as we work our way through Daniel is that the book is structured very similar to the book of Revelation. They both follow a similar pattern. The book of Daniel starts out with this sort of the really big picture, the broad picture that covers all the way from Daniel's day when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem, all the way up until the coming of Christ to establish his kingdom on the earth, and it gives this sequential kingdom. But there's not a lot of detail given regarding each kingdom. And they're identified and so forth, but as we begin to progress now into the next section where Daniel he actually has his own dream and is given the interpretation of it, what we will see is that as we progress, what's happening is the focus is turning more and more towards the final kingdoms and towards the establishment of Christ's kingdom on the earth. And so we start seeing a lot of the details being added in. You'll see Revelation's the same way. You know, it starts off with the seven seals, right? Which sort of gives the really big picture. And then as we progress through Revelation, we see the focus being turned towards the last 3.5 years of tribulation, the time of Antichrist, and then ultimately the establishment of Christ's kingdom on the earth. And Daniel does exactly the same thing. The book of Daniel is not sequential. A lot of people get confused. They look at Revelation as though it's from beginning to end. You know, this is the sequence of things, and that's not how it is. It's the big picture, then it's another picture that narrows in on, you know, the end times, and then it gets narrower and narrower, and it starts giving more and more and more detail. We have the exact same thing here in the book of Daniel. Now, about the structure of Daniel, a lot of people are confused also because they start reading. In fact, I had somebody ask me a question about this this week. I forget who it was, but Daniel gives the, you know, what such and such a year of such and such a king when a certain vision occurred, and you see that Daniel appears to backtrack, right? He talks about Darius, and then all of a sudden he's back to talking about Belshazzar. Darius was the first king installed by Cyrus after he conquered the Babylonians, and then we're back to talking about another Babylonian king that was prior to Darius. And so the reason for that is that Daniel is sort of laid out in two sections. The first part of Daniel, chapters 1 through 6, deals with, it's sort of like a historical narrative. All right, it starts out with after Nebuchadnezzar defeated Jerusalem, and then it gives the sequence of events, right? Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and then he built the image, and he, you know, wanted everyone to bow down to his golden image. We have the story of Belshazzar, Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, who took the kingdom later, and the story of the handwriting on the wall, right? This is at the end of the 70 years of exile. And then we have in chapter 6, I believe it is, we have Daniel in the lion's den. Well, that's after Cyrus had defeated the Babylonians and he installed his father-in-law, Darius the Mede, as the local ruler over Babylon after he had conquered it. And so, you know, we see that. And then the second half of the book, starting in chapter 7, is simply a collection of Daniel's own visions that occurred during the previous period. All right, so that's why you'll see it appears to go back and forth. All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to skip over all the historical stuff. We got Nebuchadnezzar's dream. That's really the big one that we wanted to deal with. We're not going to talk about Daniel and the lion's den and all those other things that happened during the Babylonian exile or during that first year after the exile. But what we want to do now is talk about Daniel's own dreams and the interpretations of those dreams that God gave to him. You may notice on the screen that there are two pictures, and they are a comparison, because what we find in Daniel chapter 7 is that God gives Daniel basically the same information, the same sequence of kingdoms that he gave to Nebuchadnezzar, represented by an image in Nebuchadnezzar's and in Daniel's visions represented by animals. But they all correspond to the very same four kingdoms, and it's an expansion on those. And what we'll also see when we look at Daniel 7 is that it begins to focus in on that final kingdom. Who is that fourth beast? Who was that? Who was those the legs of iron in Nebuchadnezzar's dream? You know, they're not actually identified as Rome, even though it was Rome. They're not actually identified as Rome in the book of Daniel. All right, but as we see, as the Bible progresses, it's very clear that that's what it was. But then, what about those 10 horns on the beast, and what about those 10 toes on Nebuchadnezzar's image? See, what Daniel, you can see Daniel is eager for the coming of the Messiah. Daniel is eager for the kingdoms, you know, the nations to be overthrown and for the Messiah to set up his kingdom on the earth. And as we go through chapter 7, you'll see how inquisitive he is and how he keeps focusing in on these, on that fourth kingdom, how it develops into the feet, or in the case of chapter 7, how it develops into the 10 horns on the beast. And then we are introduced with a new character in Daniel 7, and that is another, an 11th king who comes up at the end, who we know to be the Antichrist, all right, and how that is all going to come about. All right, so that's where we're going to be headed in Daniel chapter 7. Now, before we actually get into it, I want to remind us of a few things. First of all, last time I talked a lot about the covenant that God made with Israel through Moses, right? The Mosaic covenant. And I told you that God's, all of these things that are developing in the end times and all these things that are happening in prophecy are all related to the fulfillment of God's threats and God's promises that he made in that covenant with Israel through Moses. And we'll see more of that, especially when we get into chapter 9. Also, we talked a little bit about the covenant that God made with King David when he gave Israel a series of kings. And that covenant with David, which he then went and reiterated to Solomon, his son, and he threatened Solomon. He said, if you obey, right, then you are going to be that king that is going to fulfill the covenant that I made with David. But if you do not obey me, he said, this temple that you built, because Solomon built the first temple, right? This temple that you built, I'm going to destroy. I'm going to utterly destroy it. I'm going to take the kingdom away from you and from your sons and all that. Now, what God did in the first destruction of Jerusalem is he overthrew, or he put a stop to the fulfillment of his covenant with David regarding the kings. He brought an end to the Davidic dynasty of kings until that ultimate son of David is to rule upon the throne of David, right? Which is who? Jesus Christ, right? He will be the one to fulfill that. God did that in the first destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. But you know what he did not destroy? He did not destroy the priesthood. God preserved the priesthood. There is another covenant that's bound up in the law of Moses, and it's called the covenant of Levi. How many of you have heard of the covenant of Levi? Who can tell me what the covenant of Levi is? Just because you heard of it doesn't mean you can explain it. Excuse me?
That's not what
Zadok. No, the covenant with Levi. Who was Levi? Let's start there. Who was Levi?
Son of Jacob.
Okay, Benny's got it right. He was one of the 12 sons of Jacob, right? One of the tribes. Is that what you said? Oh, it was you. Levi was one of the 12 sons of Jacob, or who God changed his name to Israel. And what was so special about that tribe?
Priesthood.
Duke? I was just going to say, was holy, it all the things that Harry's forgiven because they didn't get a land in here?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. God singled out the tribe of Levi. All the other tribes, when Joshua took the children of Israel into the promised land, under the provisions of the law of Moses, God gave 11 of the 12 tribes a specific portion of land to inherit. He divided the land up amongst these 11. But the tribe of Levi did not get any inheritance at all in the land as a permanent possession. Now, when they got an inheritance, what did they do with it? They farmed the land, right? They were, it was agriculture was the thing. So they farmed the land. The tribe of Levi, what did Levi get instead of land to farm? Excuse me, I hear...
Of tithes of everybody else's
offering. Right, Levi's descendants became the priests. The priests at the temple, the priesthood, that whole tribe served God as the priests for the other 11 tribes. And the tribe of Levi received the tithe, 10% of the other tribes in order to support them. And so we see that going on. Now what I want to show you is, I want you to go to the book of Malachi. And let's go to chapter 2. Does anybody know when the book of Malachi was written approximately?
400 years before Christ.
Okay. Was it written before or after the Babylonian exile? It was written, Malachi was God's prophet. The book was written after Nebuchadnezzar had taken the Israelites into captivity for 70 years, and then after Cyrus defeated the Babylonians and allowed them to go back and return, they rebuilt the temple, and they picked up where they left off, right? Now, can you have temple worship without a priesthood? No. It's like, a car can't go anywhere unless you got a driver. The priesthood were the ones that were especially ordained by God to handle the things of God, to take care of all these rituals and all the things that took place at the temple. They couldn't offer sacrifices. Only the priests could do those things, right? So when God destroyed Jerusalem the first time with Nebuchadnezzar, he preserved his priesthood. And what we'll see is when Cyrus gave the decree to return, Joshua, who was the high priest, who had been in captivity for 70 years, was allowed to go back and then to pick up and resume the priestly functions as they rebuilt the temple of God. All right, so what we have with the first destruction of Jerusalem, this is very important that you understand this, is we have the overthrow of the Davidic covenant temporarily until Messiah would come, but not the overthrow of the covenant with Levi. Alright? That was not overthrown. It continued and it resumed afterwards. However, after a time of that taking place, Israel was governed actually by the priests instead of by a king. Alright? After the captivity. And that continued all the way up until the time of Christ. And when you read the Gospels, you'll see that it was the high priest and the Sanhedrin that were sort of in control. I mean, the Romans were in the background, ultimately, but they were the ones, it was the priests who seemed to be governing the nation. And that's what we see happening, is it went from the kings of Israel to now the priests governing the nation as a temporary measure until the Messiah was to come. Now, let's look at Malachi chapter 2 for just a moment. The whole book of Malachi is a condemnation of the priesthood, which had become extremely corrupt by this time. And this is before the time of Christ. And look at chapter 2, verse 1. He says, "And now, O priests, this commandment is for you. If you will not hear, and if you will not take it to heart, to give glory to my name, says the Lord of hosts, I will send a curse upon you, and I will curse your blessings. Yes, I have already cursed them, because you did not take it to heart. Behold, I will rebuke your descendants and spread refuse on your faces, the refuse of your solemn feasts. And one will take you away with it, that is the whole tribe of Levi. Then you shall know that I have sent this commandment to you, that my covenant with Levi may continue," or may resume at some points, what he's saying. says the Lord. My covenant was with him, one of life and peace, and I gave them to him that he might fear me. So he feared me and was reverent before my name. The law of truth was in his mouth, and injustice was not found on his lips. He walked with me in places, in peace and equity, and turned many away from iniquity. For the lips of the priest should keep knowledge, and people should seek the law from his mouth, for he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. But you, that is you priests, you have departed from the way. You have caused many to stumble at the law. You have corrupted the covenant of Levi, says the Lord of hosts. Therefore, I also have made you contemptible and base before all the people, because you have not kept my ways and have shown partiality in the law. Have we not all one Father? Has not one God created us? Why do we deal treacherously with one another and profane the covenant of our fathers? Judah has dwelt treacherously, and an abomination has been committed in Israel and Jerusalem. And that's talking about the kings. For Judah has profaned the Lord's holy institution, which he loves, has married the daughter of a foreign god. May the Lord cut off the tents of Jacob, the man who does this being awake and aware, yet who brings an offering to the Lord of hosts. And this is the second thing that you do. You cover the altar of the Lord with tears, with weeping and crying, so he does not regard the offering anymore, nor receive it with goodwill from your hands. And then he goes on to, you know, talk about how the priests are justifying themselves before the Lord and so forth. Now, this threat against the priesthood was carried out in the second destruction of Jerusalem, when the Romans came and they destroyed not only the temple, but they destroyed all the records of the priesthood, and the whole priesthood was eliminated. And to this day, there is no more priesthood in reserve waiting to be brought back. The only way that that can ever happen again is if God sends a prophet to come and ordain a new priesthood of the tribe of Levi in order to do that. All right. What I want you to understand is that in the first destruction of Jerusalem, God temporarily suspended the covenant that he made with King David, and there were no more kings that sat upon the throne of David until the Messiah is to come, who is of the son of David, who will fulfill that covenant. And in the same way, in the second destruction of Jerusalem, he took away the ruling class of priests from the temple and destroyed the temple a second time. And this time, he didn't leave a remnant behind, as he did with Nebuchadnezzar. You know, when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem and the temple, he left a small remnant in the land. He even appointed a governor named Jedidiah to be sort of the head over them and to keep this remnant in the land. During the 70 years of Babylonian exile, when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem, they ground it to powder. They ground it to dust. They left nothing. Nothing of the priesthood. Nothing of the Israelites. It was completely and totally obliterated. It has been that way and will be that way, at least according to prophecy, until the end times. All right? Now, I want you to turn in your Bibles to Jeremiah chapter 22. And verse 24. I mentioned this briefly last time, but I want you to see it in print. Jeremiah 22:24. As I live, says the Lord, though Coniah, and Coniah is the same man as Jeconiah and Jehoiachin, right? He was the son of King Jehoiakim that Nebuchadnezzar took captive when he brought the first hostages back. As I live, says the Lord, though Coniah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, were a signet on my right hand, yet I would pluck you off, and I would give you into the hand of those who seek your life, and into the hand of those who face you, whose face you fear, the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and the hand of the Chaldeans. So I will cast you out. Remember, he's talking to this rightful king, the last king. and your mother who bore you into another country where you were not born, and there you shall die. But to the land to which they desire to return, they shall not return. Is this man Coniah, a despised, broken idol? Now I want you to notice, he refers to the king, the rightful king of the line of David, as a idol, as a broken idol. And why do you think that is? Why did God send Israel into captivity? Idolatry, the worship of foreign gods, right? And so he compares him to a broken pagan idol, a vessel in which is no pleasure. Why are they cast out, he and his descendants, and cast into the land which they do not know? O earth, 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 hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, write this man down as childless, a man who shall not prosper in his days, for none of his descendants shall prosper sitting on the throne of David and ruling any more in Judah. That was the termination of the line of David that would actually sit upon the throne of David until Messiah comes. But I want you to notice that he immediately in chapter 23 provides the promise of hope of restoring that covenant that God made with David. Verse 5, he says, behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, that I will raise to David a branch of righteousness, a king shall reign and prosper and execute judgment and righteousness in the earth. In his days, Judah will be saved and Israel will dwell safely. Now this is his name by which he will be called, quote, the Lord our righteousness. And of course, that's a prophecy about our Lord Jesus Christ. All right, now let's go to chapter 7 of Daniel. So as the broken idol, Coniah or Jehoiachin, is taken into exile, and none of his descendants are going to sit on the throne, we have Nebuchadnezzar's idol, his image, being set up over Israel, showing that from that time until the Messiah comes, Israel is going to be ruled over by pagans. Daniel chapter 7 and verse 1.
Hey,
yes, sir.
Is the broken idol part possibly something to do with like them exalting the line of David so much and saying like basically they saw like no fault in their kings, they wanted, you know, kings to rule over them, and then he gives them the line of David and it's honored by God and it's continued on, but then the line of David gets so corrupted. They're going after other gods and all this. He's like, you're, as my king that I have anointed, they're putting you up on this pedestal, almost like an idol, broken, they're seeking me and you, and you have nothing.
There might be something to that, Duke. I don't know for sure. I mean, all I can say is he refers to this king of the Davidic line as a broken idol, and I think idol in the Old Testament is used more in the sense of a pagan god as opposed to you know, the way we kind of loosely use the term idol, like, you know, American Idol, you know, just somebody that's revered. An idol was something more than that. It was something that was seen as almost as a god or something, you know, like that. The Bible refers to idolatry quite a lot. So, I mean, the way I see it just appears to me that there's a contrast being made here between, you know, God revealing those who are going to rule over Israel as this great image, this, you know, that is really pretty brutal, as opposed to the broken idol, which was the king of the Davidic line. You know, that just seems that way to me, but I'm just giving you my opinion here. So. All right, let's look at Daniel chapter 7, and let's try to develop these themes a little more. Verse 1, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. Now this is interesting because the first year of Belshazzar. Well, Belshazzar was Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, so this is actually about three kings after Nebuchadnezzar died. Okay, his son reigned for, I believe it was 23 years. Then there was a short power struggle, and there was a couple of kings. Well, I think one reigned for 1 year and one for 4 years. And then Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, Belshazzar, became king. And Belshazzar reigned for the last 17 years of the 70-year exile. All right, so we're 17 years before the end of the exile, before Cyrus comes now and defeats Belshazzar. Belshazzar's the guy who, you know, the handwriting on the wall at the end of his kingdom and all that. That would be 17 years later after this. All right, so a lot of time has passed since Daniel gave the interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, right? I mean, 23 more years for Nebuchadnezzar, and then we had a few more years for these other kings. So quite a lot of time has passed. All right, so, and Daniel, no doubt, was, you know, seeking God and wanting more revelation about these future things. And so God is now, I apparently sees that it's time to start revealing more of this. All right, so Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. Verse 2. Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Now, what is the great sea? Can anybody tell me what the great sea is? It's the Mediterranean. The great sea in the Bible is always the Mediterranean. It's that enormous sea, the Red Sea. The Red Sea is called the Red Sea by name, right? And there are, the Sea of Galilee is called the Sea of Galilee by name. But what you should always keep in mind when you look at these prophecies is they are always from the perspective of Israel. They're not give, this prophecy is not given from the perspective of Babylon or in the, you know, in the Far East or way over there. The vision is, even though Daniel's in Babylon, the vision is he's seeing what's happening over the Mediterranean Sea, and he's seeing this big storm taking place on the Mediterranean Sea, which is along the coast of Israel. All right, so he says, I saw, behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Where are the four winds? What does that expression refer to in the Bible? Right, the four directions of the compass, north, south, east, and west. All right. And it's from the perspective of Israel again, right? North, south, east, and west of Israel. Verse 3. And four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Now, what do you think that was? Yeah, I mean, if we look at what you see on the screen there, we see Nebuchadnezzar's image on the left and Daniel's dream on the right of four animals. And these are, as I said before, these are parallel to each other. The head is parallel to the first animal. The chest is parallel to the second animal and so forth. So the head would be Nebuchadnezzar. Now, what happened to Nebuchadnezzar? And does this actually refer to a historical fact? And what is it referring to?
His 7 years.
Excuse me?
His time of being a wild beast.
His time of insanity, yeah. Right? Daniel chapter 4. If you read Daniel 4, you see that Nebuchadnezzar, because of his pride and arrogance, that God humbled him by driving him insane for a period of 7 years until he was humbled before God. Actually, Daniel 4 is a pretty fascinating chapter if you read it, because that chapter was actually written by Nebuchadnezzar. It's his words telling the story of what happened to him, and it's been included in the book of Daniel. But anyway, that's what this is referring to, about the man's heart being given to him. That is, he was humbled by God. And suddenly another beast, a second like a bear, it was raised up on one side, and it had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. Now, what was the bear? If it's parallel to Nebuchadnezzar's image, it would be parallel to the chest of silver, right? Which was the Persians. Why do you think there are 3 ribs in its mouth? What's that? Yeah, but do they represent anything specific? Anybody? Well, who did the Persians conquer? They actually conquered 3 major kingdoms. Babylonians, Lydia, and Egypt. And I believe that's what the 3 ribs probably represent. Verse 5. After this I looked, and there was another like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird. The beast also had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. Now, what would a leopard represent? I mean, a bear would represent something really ferocious, right?
Speed.
Agility. Speed and agility. And really, there's really no better animal to represent Alexander the Great and his kingdom, because he conquered the known world with such speed that it was mind-boggling. Nation after nation just fell before his army, just like that. He just went out there and conquered them all. By the time he was 33 years old, he was like, there's nothing left for me to conquer. You know? And so we see that. And then, of course, it's got four heads and four wings. What would four wings represent? Well, it probably represents the spread in all directions, right? North, south, east, and west of Israel. And the four heads, what happened to Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom? I'm sorry, Alexander's kingdom when he died. He had no heir, and it was divided up amongst his four generals. And so we see that represented here as well. All right, let's move on to verse 7. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong, and it had huge iron teeth. It was devouring and breaking in pieces and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the other beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Now, what is it about this terrible beast? He doesn't tell us what kind of a species of animal it was, and the reason he probably didn't tell us is because he didn't recognize it. You know, if you saw a lion, you could recognize a lion. You know, if you saw a leopard, you could recognize a leopard. If you saw some monstrous thing that you'd never seen before, you couldn't put a name on it, right? Except it was extremely terrible and frightening to Daniel. Let me get through these here. I forgot to advance my slides. All right. Now, what is it about this beast when he says it was different than the beasts that were before it? Look at the passage. What do you think he means by that? Okay, what else?
Exceedingly strong.
What? Yes, but how? In what way is it destroying?
It's a power.
Yeah, see, the other beasts, yes, they defeated their predecessors. This beast totally obliterates and annihilates, right? Look what it says here. He says he's devouring and breaking in pieces and trampling the residue, that whatever is left, even after he's devouring and breaking in pieces, whatever is left, he's trampling it with his feet. Right, does somebody say something?
Yeah, it doesn't say, is it actually telling us that what these beasts are successive? Because the residue of what is it trampling the residue of, or the rest of the beasts, or the rest of the land?
No, the rest of what it broke in pieces. It says it's breaking in pieces and trampling the remainder, or that is what was broken in pieces.
So,
with its feet.
I'm just curious, does this passage teach us that these beasts are successive? I know we're making the analogy that it's the same as the other statue, and because the statue is said to be succession, mm-hmm. You know, that these beasts, because these beasts don't have anything to do with each other.
Well, let me say this. After we look at the beasts, then Daniel inquires of the angel what it means, and according to the angel, yes, they are successive. Okay, and he actually identifies some of them. Okay, so yes, they're absolutely successive in succession. They're not contemporaries with each other. All right, now let's look at verse 8. I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them. Now, how many horns did this beast have?
Ten.
All right, but there's another one coming up among them, which means after the first horns are there, right? The 10 horns, what do they correspond with on Nebuchadnezzar's vision?
The 10 toes,
right? We've got the same thing. All right. I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. Let's see if I can get this picture up here. I like that picture. Huh? I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. His garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, its wheels a burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him, 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, this is important, the court was seated, and the books were opened. I watched then. Then is a sequential word, by the way, which means after the court is seated. I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. What I want you to notice is that even after the court, the heavenly court, the Ancient of Days is seated and the thrones are put in place and this courtroom is set up, that even after that, this little horn is spouting off his mouth. All right? I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. I watched till the beast was slain and its body destroyed and given to the burning flame. Now, what is he saying? First of all, don't confuse the horn with the beast. We're talking about the fourth beast, which was dreadful and terrible and unlike all the beasts that were before it. And this beast had 10 horns, right? And those 10 horns represent 4 kings that will arise, as we'll see a little bit later. Then this 11th king comes up. After the heavenly court is seated, he is spouting off his pompous words. And then what happens in response to him spouting off his pompous words? What happens next? It says the beast was slain. Now what is the beast? What is the fourth beast? We talked about this. What was the fourth kingdom in Nebuchadnezzar's dream? It's the Roman Empire, the one that ground Jerusalem to dust and to powder. It's the Roman Empire. And these 10 horns are going to come out of the Roman Empire. All right? And then this little beast, this little horn, is going to come up among them. But he's going to be different than them. And he's going to be spouting off. And then the beast, the fourth beast, which is the Roman Empire, is going to be destroyed and burned because of his pompous words. All right, we'll get back to that in a little while. All right, what we'll find as we progress is that the book of Revelation actually takes this prophecy and expands on it. For example, the heavenly court that is seated is described in Revelation chapters 4 through 6. And it is the opening of the seals. It talks about the thrones, the 24 thrones that are there, the elders, and the judgment is being passed upon this kingdom of the Antichrist. That's the heavenly court that Daniel's talking about here. And it's during that period of time that we'll see that Rome is burned, according to Revelation chapter 17, just as Daniel said. Yes, do you have a question?
Yeah. Why are the horns considered?
Because of where they come from. They are going to actually come out of the fourth beast, but then they're going to turn on that beast that they came out of and destroy it. All right, we'll get to that when we get to the interpretation, when the angel talks about that, all right? What I want you to write in your margin of your Bible and make sure you understand this, is that this heavenly court that he's talking about is not at the end of the tribulation. No. It's at the beginning. All right? It is God's passing judgment upon the beasts and upon their kingdoms, because he's going to send his king to overthrow them and rule. And there's a period of judgments that are poured out by God, one after the other, upon this kingdom, until finally the Son of Man is dispatched to completely obliterate it. All right, as we'll see, this is actually sequential. A lot of people, when they read this section of Daniel chapter 7, they think it's jumping back and forth in its events, and it's not. It is sequential. The heavenly court is seated first, and God is placed on the throne. John was caught up to heaven in Revelation chapter 4 in order to witness the heavenly court being seated that is going to pronounce the destruction of the kingdoms of the world and the kingdom of this final these final 10 kings and the Antichrist that is with them. All right, so he continues. This is in sequence. So after the heavenly court is seated, what do we have? We have this little horn spewing out his pompous words, which is the Antichrist, and so forth. And then John continues watching, and this is sequential, and he sees the fourth beast being destroyed and given to the burning fire. And we read all about that in Revelation chapters 17 and 18, when mystery Babylon, the mother of harlots, is burned with fire. This is what gives birth to the ten horns, and then the ten horns, along with the Antichrist, overthrow it and destroy it. All right, then he goes on. He says, as for the rest of the beasts, that is, what's left of Babylon, what's left of the Persians, what's left of the Greek empires, he says, the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. And that's that latter half of the time of tribulation. Verse 13, I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. Well, that's pretty self-explanatory, isn't it? We now have the second coming of Christ at the end of that time of tribulation. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. All right, that's the end of the vision. Then I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit within my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near to one of those who stood by and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. These great beasts, which are four kings, which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Then I wish to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth as iron and its nails of bronze, which devoured broken pieces and trampled the residue with its feet, and the ten horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up, before which three fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them, until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. Thus he said, quote, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms and shall devour the whole earth. Now, a lot of people, they misunderstand the word earth in the Bible. And this is one of the reasons why I think there's a lot of confusion about these prophecies. The word earth simply means land. And context determines what it refers to. Okay? It can mean the land of Israel. It can mean the whole Roman Empire. It can mean the whole Babylonian Empire. It can mean various things in various contexts. All right? Anyway, he says, where was I? Verse 23. The fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on the land, which shall be different from all other kingdoms, shall devour the whole land, trample it, break it in pieces. The ten horns are ten kings who shall arise from this kingdom. Now that's very clear here that the ten horns arise from the fourth kingdom. Right? Everybody agree with that? Which is also in agreement with the image of Nebuchadnezzar, where the feet of iron and clay with the ten toes proceed out of the legs of iron. And another shall rise after them. He shall be different from the first ones, and shall subdue three kings, and shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hands for a time, times, and half a time. How long is that? 3.5 years. But the court shall be seated. They shall take away his dominion and consume it and destroy it forever. Then the kingdom, the dominion, and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. This is the end of the account. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly troubled me, and my countenance changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. Now, yes, Mike.
Just to clarify, the saints at 25 are Christian?
Well, it would probably include Christians, but the focus of these prophecies is Israel.
So Israel being referred to as saints?
Well, there are some holy ones of Israel, right? There are saints of Israel. There are, I think we make a mistake if we try to interject later revelation into these old passages. From Daniel's perspective, what is his view of this? He's talking about the righteous of Israel, right? Here being persecuted by in the end times, and we actually see that in the with 144,000 revelation, we've got 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes and so forth, right? So let's not try to read more into it than I think Daniel would from his own perspective with the knowledge that he had at the time. All right. Are we going to be preserved? Are there promises of preservation for us that we can latch onto? Yeah, maybe, but not directly. It would be indirectly. Okay? Does that make sense? What? Now, I don't want to go too much farther than this right now. Does anybody have any questions or comments about this so far? Yes, Tim.
I saw a comment about these being in succession because the detail given now in the interpretation, I don't think, unless I'm just reading it wrong, says anything about them being in succession. For one thing, when these beasts are, with the fourth kingdom in verse 23, the fourth kingdom on the earth shall be different from all the other kingdoms.
Mm-hmm.
That would have them being different than a few verses later in 24 when the horn is different from all the others. The horn is contemporaneous with the other horns, obviously.
Well, it says he's going to rise after them. It says that the little horn arises after them, after the ten horns.
So it's just a matter of short. More or less, though, the horns are not arising hundreds of years after each other.
If these are not sequential, then this entire vision has nothing to do with Nebuchadnezzar's vision or dream. You would have to completely separate it from Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And not only that,
that would be a problem.
What's that?
Why would that be a problem?
Because then what you end up with is a bunch of disjointed prophecies that are not even related to each other. As you read the book of Daniel, what you're going to see is that he keeps giving more and more and more information about what has already been revealed, not just throwing something entirely different out of left field at Daniel. As we get into chapter 8, you'll see that he specifically names two of these kingdoms as the kingdom of Persia, followed by the kingdom of Greece. Right? We'll see Persia and Greece popping up again in chapter 10, right? So,
what's really challenging to me is back there in verse 12, as for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their life were prolonged for a season of time. In the scheme of, if you apply that verse to the statue, it doesn't make sense.
Sure it does, because the remnants of all these kingdoms are still around today. Iraq is the remnants of the Babylonian kingdom. Iran is the remnants of the Persian Empire. The Macedonian Empire of Alexander still exists, but in a limited form. It's not that dominant kingdom anymore. It has become, superseded by other kingdoms that have come after it.
So the remnant of the dominion, I mean their authority or dominion, it says that their dominion was taken away. What does that mean if it's just the remnant of people?
It means, see, throughout all these, throughout these visions, throughout these kingdoms that have arisen all down through the book of Daniel, there has been one dominant kingdom that has overthrown the authority of the other kingdoms. Does that mean those other kingdoms don't exist anymore? No, they still exist, but they are not the dominant empire anymore. There's another dominant empire. Look at the Roman Empire came in and absorbed all of Alexander's, with exception of the very far east. Absorbed all of Alexander's kingdom eventually and maintained control over that. But did the Seleucids still exist? Yes, they did, but they were dominated by the Romans. Just like Israel, the nation of Israel, did they exist? Did they have a government? Did they have territory, yes, but who was dominating them? The Roman Empire, right? They were the ones who were, you know, they basically had to ask Rome permission to do anything. You know, and this is what's happened throughout all these kingdoms. Did the Babylonian kingdom cease to exist when Cyrus defeated them? No, but what happened? Cyrus installed his own guy as king of Babylon. So Cyrus was a supreme authority over all those other kingdoms, but those other kingdoms, the kingdom of Egypt, all these kingdoms, Macedonia, all of them continue to exist and all still exist to this very day. But they no longer have that, they no longer had that supreme authority when these other kingdoms would rise up over them and suppress them. Right? So in one sense, they're contemporaneous with each other, in one sense, but he's talking about the kingdoms that are gaining the supremacy in a sequence. And clearly, I mean, just look at history, and you can see that's exactly what's happening.
I agree with that, other than it seems as though in that verse, there is a specific dominion or an authority that is taken away at the same time that the beast's body is destroyed.
Yes, because the Antichrist is the one who is now reigning over those nations. The little horn, their dominion was taken away because the Antichrist expands his kingdom now, and he is now over all these other nations. So their dominion is taken away when he gains that power.
There's just so many characters. You have 10 horns. Well, dominion is taken away at that time. But
no, their dominion is not taken away. Revelation 13 says that they give their dominion voluntarily to the beast. Right? So this is something they all collude together to allow him to take total control. He doesn't overthrow them. Yes.
So when we see three kingdoms or nations that were part of the former Roman Empire give their power or unify with some other leader or entity.
We first have to see the 10 kings.
What if we can't identify them?
Oh, I think we'll identify them clearly.
There's 10 kings out there, but we see three that are part of the former Roman Empire.
I don't think Daniel's prophecy would be this explicit. I mean, do we have any trouble identifying the head of gold? Do we have any trouble identifying the chest of silver? I mean, the Bible has given us so much information, and these things are so prominent as they're being fulfilled in history, that when the 10 toes are on the scene, we're not going to have any trouble at all identifying who they are. He tells us they come out of the legs of iron. I mean, that's evident in Nebuchadnezzar's thing, right? We have these 10 horns that come up on this fourth beast. Right, so they come out of this fourth beast. Is it hard to identify the Roman Empire, the remnants of the Roman Empire today? No, it's basically Europe, plus Syria and Egypt, right? That's the remnants of the Roman Empire. Are we going to have any trouble finding 10 kings who take sort of sovereign power and are prominent? Right now, do we have kings in Europe? No, it's sort of a democracy, right? And it's kind of a loosely held together thing, but these 10 kings are going to come out of the old Roman Empire, and they are going to be kings, which means they are going to be all simultaneously reigning at the same time. Listen, I don't believe we're going to have any trouble at all identifying them. And in fact, I believe that we're going to be seeing them coming to power very, very soon. All right, that's my opinion. And anyway, go ahead. Yeah.
I was thinking of like Yugoslavia when the Soviet bloc installed Tito. You know,
yeah. What's happening? You know what? Look at Europe right now. What's happening to Europe?
Coming apart.
Why are they coming apart?
No.
Okay, nationalism is going to be a key, but why is there such an outcry for nationalism right now?
Immigration.
They're being invaded by Muslims. Is that right? They're being invaded by Muslims, and they're changing the whole culture, and the people are saying enough is enough. Is that right? When you get invaded by a foreign people in that way, they become part of your country and they have the right to vote. They're going to turn your country into something you never even imagined. Isn't that right? So what are the people who are, you know, from there, what are they going to do? They're going to cry out that, you know what, this democracy thing isn't working for us. We need a powerful and a strong leader. And Europe is going to break up. I'm telling you right now, it's going to break up into 10 regions ruled by 10 powerful kings, and it's not going to be the kind of democracy that you've seen in the past. It's going to be more of a combination of democracy and dictatorship, which is why the iron and the clay mixture that in the feet of the image has talked about there, why it doesn't cohere together and it's going to fall apart. That's what's coming. I promise you, watch for that. That's what is coming to Europe. Right? The whole EU thing, that's going to break up. And there are going to be 10 strong, powerful kings that rise up from the Roman Empire and are going to take charge. Yeah. We should view all Bible prophecy as Israel-focused, as Jerusalem-centric. It's all about the land that God promised to his people, and it's all about the covenants that he has made. It's about the threats he has made against Israel and the nations and the promises that he has made. Everything revolves around Israel. When we start taking ourselves out of that and start looking at it from America perspective, and we try to find America and Bible prophecy and, you know, Mystery Babylon is America and all this other nonsense, that has nothing to do with Bible prophecy. Okay, that's just fad eschatology. That's not biblical-centered eschatology. Everything in the Bible revolves around God's promises and his threats to the nation of Israel. Yes? In relation to Israel land. And look at, why would he call the fourth beast more dreadful than the others? Why is it more dreadful than the others? You know, it's not more dreadful from our perspective. It's more dreadful from Israel's perspective. It's more dreadful from Jerusalem's perspective. Why is that? Because, look, when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem, what did he do? He broke down the walls. He destroyed the temple. He took some people captives. He was pretty merciful, actually. He left some in the land to farm the land, right? And Jerusalem, they didn't have worship at the temple now, you know, for 70 years. But when the Romans came in, what did they do? What did Jesus say? What did Jesus say when he talked about this? He said that the day is coming when your enemies are going to surround you. Read it. It's Luke chapter 19 and Luke 21. You know, he said they're not going to leave in you one stone upon another. That's not going to be thrown down. Everything is going to be obliterated. Josephus talks about it. He was an eyewitness to those events. And he says there, you could not even tell there was a city there when the Romans got done with it. I mean, they absolutely demolished everything. What's that? Yes. Is that what that is? Yeah. He ground them to powder. And that's, I think, why Daniel is talking about this fourth beast being so much more dreadful. And not only breaking it in pieces, but then grinding it into the dust, whatever remains. It's the city of Jerusalem. It's Judea. It's the people of Israel that Rome has done that to. Yes.
The way they number the beasts, the way that it's written, it has to just command a sequence, and not that it's just given a number of kingdoms or kings, but it's given a sequence the way it's written.
Well, when it says the first and the second and the third and the fourth, I mean, normally those are sequential numbers. Yeah, I mean, if the Bible talks about the seven vials or the seven bowls of wrath, I mean, they're numbered because they are sequential.
Just like the days of the week.
You know, there are theories today. I mean, the whole Islamic Antichrist theory also, it denies that the fourth beast is the Roman Empire. In fact, it completely removes the Roman Empire from Bible prophecy for the most part, pretending that the Romans had nothing to do with Israel, you know. But what about, they ruled Israel, they crucified Christ, they destroyed Jerusalem and the temple, they sent Israel into exile, and they're still in exile. And the Romans have nothing to do with this? Seriously? You know, I mean, it's a joke to me. I mean, how much that view just completely overturns the scriptures. But what's the purpose of it? Because it's what I would refer to as fad eschatology. Because instead of looking at the prophecies from the covenants and the promises and the threats that God has made to Israel, let's just look at it from our modern times. And who's the boogeyman right now? Yeah. Islam is the boogeyman. So that must be the Antichrist. I think that view is very narrow, narrowly sighted, and it doesn't really take into account what the perspective of Israel from the Bible.
Yeah, it's not Jerusalem-centric either. It's
No, it's
not. It's centered in on that actual
prophecy. It's centered on, that theory is centered on, it's more that these prophecies are viewed from a Babylonian perspective, okay, as a Far Eastern perspective, as opposed to from a Jerusalem century perspective. But anyway, that's my opinion on that one. But yeah.
I was just thinking about the whole dominion part with the kingdoms and everything, but it makes sense, like if you have kingdoms, initially you have kings that are over those places, so when you eliminate the king, even though the city still stands, you get rid of that power, that dominion.
Right, and then the new authority takes over.
The people are still there.
The people are still there, they're still the same ethnic people, right? They still have the same history. And that's what we see happening in this succession of kingdoms. It's a change in authority that's taking place, not necessarily, you know, cities and countries disappear off the map and are replaced by something else. That's not what happens.
Right. Yeah, dude. Like Rome represented an anti-Christian oppression over the city of Israel, but yeah. If you look at Italy right now, it's not new Congress. People still exist. Ethnically, there's still people there. But so that's not an Antichrist empire.
No.
The same thing with the Greeks. You know, it's not even the same. I mean, that's really not even the same people.
Now, as we get into chapter 8, just a second, Jeff. As we get into chapter 8, we're going to see that Daniel, he's asking the angel here about that little horn and about the very end. Who is this little guy that's just showing up now in this vision at the very end, who is, you know, speaking all these pompous words and all this kind of stuff? You know, who is that guy? And in chapter 8, he's going to have another dream, another vision that's going to zero in and focus in on the identity of this guy and where he comes from, and that's going to be actually even more relevant for us as we're going to be looking for that, you know, playing out in the end times. Yeah, I think Jen had her hand up. Yeah. Yeah. Well, from Daniel's perspective, it's just those who are righteous before God. You know, it's without being that specific. Oh, Joshua the high priest?
Yes. That's not the same Joshua that
was. No, he was, that was much. No, when Nebuchadnezzar came and destroyed Jerusalem, he put an end to the kings, the line of kings from David. All right, he put an end to that. But the high priest was allowed to continue to be high priest, even though he didn't have a temple to function in. He went through the entire exile, and then at the end of the exile, Joshua the high priest, along with Zerubbabel, who was given the place of governor, were allowed to lead the people back under Cyrus to rebuild the temple. And it was done under the supervision of Joshua the high priest. All right, so the Levite, yes. So the priesthood was not abolished in the first destruction of Jerusalem. But when the Romans did it, it was completely obliterated. There was no more priesthood at all. Even the records of who was of what line and their ancestry, which, you know, in order to meet the qualifications, you had to have all that. All that stuff was burned with the temple, and it was completely gone.
Now in Israel, I know that they're trying to bring that back, trying to identify all the priests.
Yeah, but they can't do it. Actually, you can't do it without a prophet of God. In fact, even when they went and rebuilt the never mind, I'm thinking of something entirely different. Never mind. Yeah.
What you're saying is they're trying to go back and find that line that came from the last prophet. But
yeah, there's different. There's different.
What they're doing. Plus, they messed it up the way that you spoke about yesterday, where they're determining lines paternally instead of paternally.
Yeah, they've got it all screwed up. There are different segments of Jewish thought about rebuilt temple and resuming worship and how that can come about. There are some that are very liberal in their thinking, and they don't really take the Bible literally and kind of stuff, and so they got certain ideas. But there are others who are more strict in their and literalist in their interpretations of the law of Moses. And that group knows, I mean, they're trying to get things ready, but only because they believe the prophecy, the last a chapter in the Old Testament that says God is going to send Elijah the prophet in order to restore all things, and that means to restore the law of Moses.
Like
right? So they have to have that prophet to anoint the high priest in order to be able to resume the functions in the temple and all that. So that more strict segment of Judaism understands that even though they might be trying to get furniture ready, trying to get priestly robes made, trying to get all these things, that they can't really pull the trigger on this until Elijah the prophet shows up. And he is going to show up according to the book of Revelation. So, yes.
Are we, or can you discuss any about why the Nebuchadnezzar's dream about the 10 feet being partly iron, partly clay, what that really means and what that has to do with the 10 horns?
Okay, it's talking about the feet itself, not just the 10 toes, right? The feet were partly iron and partly clay. And then it says in the Nebuchadnezzar's dream that as iron does not mix with clay, you know, that they're not going to adhere to one another. It says they will mingle with the seed of men. A lot of people are confused about that.
Yeah.
All right. All I can tell you is the way that the early church fathers interpreted that pretty uniformly. And that was that they were talking about the ruling class, royalty, mixing with the lower classes, the common people. And the seed of men was actually, I believe in the Latin version of the Bible, was a reference to the commoners. And so this idea that you can have, you know, you have monarchies where you have kings, where you have royalty ruling over a people, that's a certain form of government, right? And then you have democracy, which is ruled by the people. Well, Rome itself tried to mix those two things together, right? They had the Republic, they had the Senate, then they had the emperors, but then it didn't work out. And the emperors ended up seizing control, you know, and ruled basically like almost like a monarchy, although it wasn't necessarily family lines, right? Because it doesn't work. Having a monarchy and trying to mix it with a democracy, it just doesn't work. Well, I think what the early church fathers understood it that way because of, I think, the Roman model. And so they talk, when they talk about the 10 toes, they talk about it being this mixture of democracy and monarchy. They're going to try to set up these 10 democracies, but have a strong leader. It's kind of hard to do that if the people are voting, you know. So anyway, that was the mixture according to them. You know, I don't have a better theory than that.
Did I try to mix with the CNN by marrying this daughter and this son? Within the later Roman Empire.
They did.
They tried to do that and it wasn't successful.
It was never successful. They tried doing all kinds of things so that the people had a voice in government, but ultimately the people were going in a direction that the leaders didn't want to go, and so they would overthrow the world.
So the 10 kings are going to be like the iron. But the strength in the iron, so these 10 horns.
And the weakness will be in the democracy part of it. Yeah. Stephen, yeah.
The situation you're describing almost sounds like the people of the democracy ascended the martial law to deal with their immediate circumstances.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be.
So it's going to be a contentious government with the people.
Yeah, and it's going to have a strong man that's, you know, going to have to just rise above all the fuss going on with everybody trying to pull in every other direction.
So it sounds like the 10 kingdoms are going to have a lot of unrest, and they're going
yes,
to have a strong leader.
And they're only going to be there a short time as well, according to the book of Revelation. Read Revelation 17. It talks about these 10 kings and how that eventually they're going to just turn over their dominion to the beast. And it's probably going to be because it's contentious, and how they're going to turn on Mystery Babylon and burn her with fire and all that. We just read about it right here in chapter 7, verse 11.
Wouldn't yes. that be the strong leader that's going to pull all these together?
Yeah, then we're ultimately going to have one leader.
Yeah.
And the other 10 are going to voluntarily turn over their dominion to that one who hears the little horn. In Revelation, we'll see that it's the Antichrist.
But we don't know we're doing it, though.
Well,
what it is people are
going to
want peace.
Right. Well, you know, the situation is just going to get so ugly that they're going to cry for a strong man to try to bring some kind of...
Probably what's happening in Greece now.
And it's really starting to happen here, too, if you think about it.
The economics will play a giant role.
You can want peace so badly, you don't care. If someone promised you they can bring peace, you're not really looking at maybe the character of the person.
Yeah.
If they can bring peace out of this chaos that's going on.
Yeah, people will vote for that.
Most of us are going to go that way, and we don't, and we may not know who we're voting for.
It's true. It's certainly true. Yeah. So, yes. I can hardly hear you with this air conditioner blowing behind me.
Because the Western world is not supposed to be mentioned in the Bible anywhere, anything, lies to us.
Well, when you say Western world, are you talking about the Americas?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think, in my opinion, I've studied the Bible for 35 years, and I haven't seen anything in the Bible that I could say specifically refers to America. Okay, when you say West, that's different because, I mean, the West from a Israel point of view would really be most of Europe. All right, that is definitely in Bible. Okay, but the far west, like across the Atlantic Ocean, I don't see anything in the Bible that specifically deals with that. I'm not saying I couldn't have missed something, but...
Could it be that we just become part of one of those things?
It could be, or we might not be part of it at all.
Yeah. Or the place of safety.
We have no bearing on that.
Not saying that it is.
Nope, but again, we're starting to mix a lot of speculation.
Right.
And I want to be clear, and there's nothing wrong with us speculating about how it's going to play out in our day, but we need to be clear that we are speculating.
Amen.
Because I don't want to say, thus saith the Lord, and it doesn't turn out that way.
You're on camera.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, boy. So that it sounds like you're saying it.
Yeah.
Who puts it in the
Lord? Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead. No, we should. Yeah, don't. Let's not. That's the problem with people is we are, you know, as far as we're concerned, history began the day we were born. Right? That's world history, the day we were born. That's all we really know. We read about other stuff that supposedly happened in the past, but we didn't see it. Right? And so our worldview is pretty much our limited experience and so forth. It's really a challenge for us as people to reach outside of that and educate ourselves and be able to look at things from different perspectives. Really, if you're going to understand the Bible, you've got to get away from your little me-centered world. You've got to actually read the history in the Bible and saturate yourself with the history of the Bible and then put yourself in that history as though you're one of those characters living through that. And try to look at these prophecies from that perspective because, I mean, this was given to Daniel, and Daniel was one of the guys that was carried off to Babylon, you know, out of Israel. And he's not concerned with the United States of America. He could care less if it even exists at any point in time. He's concerned about his people. He's concerned about the land that was just laid desolate by Nebuchadnezzar. He's concerned about God's promises that he made in the law of Moses to restore Israel to the land. He's concerned about the coming of the Messiah that you know, David the king. That's what he's concerned about, and that's what the angels and his dreams are addressing, not our little world. Okay, how we fit into that? Okay, we can speculate about that, but really, that's not, shouldn't be the central focus. And I think most of these views that go off the rails, in my opinion, are because people leave that behind. They don't take a broad perspective of world history, for one thing, and they try to interpret everything along the lines of current events. You know, it's the whole Jack Van Impe thing, you know, everything, I don't care if the Pope has gas, there's a prophecy about it, you know, in the Bible that he can find, you know, it's ridiculous. And, you know, it's the wrong perspective. We have to put ourselves in the place of these people and view it through the covenants that God gives. All right?